truly an honor to introduce my guest, Italian journalist and novelist Oriana Fallaci. She's well known in America for her revealing interviews with political leaders, dictators, and revolutionaries. Her most quoted interviews in this country are perhaps with Henry Kissinger and the Ayatollah Khomeini. She's also well known for her books, which include Letter to a Never-Born Child. She's also covered bombing raids in Vietnam and was wounded in covering the student riots in Mexico City in 1968. She's recently been in China interviewing political leaders there. What many of Oriana Fallaci's readers are learning about now are the 3 years of her life which she shared with her lover and companion, Alexander Panagoulis, who she first met when she flew to Greece to interview him after his release from prison. He was imprisoned after a failed attempt to assassinate Greek dictator George Papadopoulos. He was condemned to death, which he was saved from at the last moment through the protests of international leaders. He was to remain in prison in a coffin-sized cell where he was tortured repeatedly until freed during a general amnesty. In her new book, which is called A Man, Fallaci writes about Panagoulis, his assassination attempt, imprisonment, her first meeting with him, their stormy relationship, his continued political activities, and finally his death, which she is certain was murder, a death engineered by his political enemies. Her book, A Man, is published by Simon & Schuster. Welcome to Fresh Air. It's a great honor to meet you.
Thank you.
Your book seems like it's in part a mission to tell the world about Alekos, who was your lover and who was...
My companion.
Your companion, yes.
My accomplice, my brother.
Why do you feel like you have a mission to tell the world about him?
Yes, I have the duty. Let's use a better word. I hate the word mission. The duty to tell, to recall to the people who knew him that he was born and lived and died as he did, that he existed and so well. And I have the duty to tell to the others who didn't know him, like the Americans, because in America, indeed, he was not known. I mean, in Europe, he was the symbol of freedom, the symbol of resistance. You have no idea, you mentioned intervention of the heads of state to spare his life, but you don't know what happened in the streets of Rome, of Paris, of Zurich, of Bonn, of London in those days. Riots, clashes with the police, shooting for the outrage for his condemnation to death. So in Europe we did know him so well, but in America you don't, and I feel well because finally the Americans know him. I want this man to be less dead if possible, but this would be, if it were only so, it would be too personal. It wouldn't be fair, and it wouldn't be not even too serious, because everybody loves somebody and wants to be less dead. The point is what this man represented, what this man symbolized. I mean, he represented so many other people, not so many, but they do exist, thanks God, all over the world, and or who have existed or who will exist. And I must say this. If I hadn't met Alekos, or if Alekos were now alive, I would write the book the same, in another way, choosing or maybe inventing another character. But I would, because I think that this book had to be written, this book about the people who fight alone, who struggle alone, who don't accept to be schematized, cataloged, and who are finally defeated, but they go on the same as they must.
I think that part about being alone is a key thing that you write about in your book, because you stress time and time again that he wasn't part of a political party and didn't want to be a part of one. He didn't have a specific ideology that he espoused. And he also seemed to distrust the people, in terms of the people as a large group.
Now, but let's begin with answering this. It is not exact to say that he had not a political ideology. Otherwise, he would be a rebel without cause, and there is nothing that I don't accept as much as that. I mean, he was not James Dean. He was a political man, God knows. He did not recognize himself in the established ideologies, in the dogmas that rules our life.
So he wasn't
not
a communist,
those of the right.
He wasn't a socialist.
He was not a communist. He couldn't be a communist. He was too much of a libertarian to be a communist. I mean, the dogma, the communist dogma wouldn't fit Alekos as it doesn't fit me. This doesn't mean that I respect many communists in my country who are, besides, they are very particular communists, but I'm not a communist. The word for me, I wanted to make that point because the word for me is not a dirty word as it is for you in America very often. Of course, he could not be a conservative. I mean, he was certainly not, I laughed just in pronouncing the words, a man of the right. I wouldn't call him not even a man of the center. It isn't, of course, he was not that, in spite of the fact that he accepted to be elected with the Union Center Party, which was not really a part of the center. It was a socialist party, social democratic party. He didn't recognize in those ideologies, and overall, as he did in the last part of his life, he was fighting these kind of intellectual dictatorship, intellectual terrorism of the political parties. I mean, there was a distinction for him, as it is for me, between what I call in the book the politics of the politicians, lies, arrogances, phony promises that will not be kept, both on the right and on the left. He had it. He was certainly, I remember during the interview, he said with a funny smile, "You're not looking for labels on me, are you? But if you want it, if you need it desperately, I authorize you somehow to use the word socialist." But it was not even that, you see. It was much more than that. Let's put it like that. Which made him find so alone. For instance, when he made the attempt to the life of Papadopoulos, to the tyrant, dictator, he had nobody with him. He did the thing all alone. You know, he went to bring the mines on that street. He had, of course, he had somebody. When I say nobody, I mean he had not a party. He had not a political movement. He had a group of people that he called the Greek Resistance Movement, which were all arrested with him. I mean, have you ever heard of a resistance fighter who goes to put a bomb with a taxi? A taxi, the taxi of the cousin, by the way. He took a taxi because his cousin, otherwise he would go by bicycle. That was the fact. What was the second part? I forgot.
Well, he said to you a few times to beware of false revolutionaries. Who do you feel are those false revolutionaries that one should distrust?
For instance, those that now... do the trouble, all the trouble in my country, for instance. Those who call themselves revolutionary and nothing but terrorists, who use the red flag to dirt the red flag. You see, in fact, they kill progressive people, democratic people, they kill communists, so we know. Listen, there is such an inflation, for Christ's sake, of all these words. Democracy, freedom, socialism, communism, revolution. And I think that the most abused word is the word revolution. And don't forget that the fascist movements in the West always started with the word revolutionary. Revolution. Mussolini called himself a revolutionary, for Christ's sake. He came from the Socialist Party. Hitler called himself revolutionary. But even Pinochet... spoke of revolution. Even Papadopoulos spoke of revolution. You see, what do they mean by revolution? That's why I don't like when here in America they want to, even if they have read the book, and now many people begin to have read the book, they use the word revolutionary, and it kind of disturbs me. Because by revolutionary here you mean someone that goes in the street making noise or causing blood. That is not revolution. Jalekos used to say, revolution is patience. You see, that kind of revolution, once you have done it, it seems that things change for a while. Every revolution will be followed by its Napoleon. That's what I say in this book, what he says.
You say the word revolution is, and all the isms are inflated words and that they're used at this point without having any meaning. Another term that is used a lot is the people. What's going to be done to liberate the people or for the people. Now, you quote him as saying that one of his goals was to, quote, to upset the flock for an hour or a day. And at times he seemed to see, quote, the people as being... sheep in a way, willing to follow a false revolutionary or willing to buy into an inflated cause or a cause that didn't have enough because intelligence people, or commitment behind it.
Well, when I speak of the people with their rage, when he speaks of the people, and I speak through him, of course, and it was another belief in which we shared. We speak of the people who don't get compromised ever. They want to protect the little they have, and here it might be a swimming pool, there it might be a car. And they say, well, I would like very much, but I can't, you know, I have a wife, I have children. And dictatorship, at any extent, in any form, cannot take place if the people don't participate. And the form of non-participation is a participation. Because when when the crowds accept in silence, out of fear or of convenience, of interest, I would like, but I cannot, as they say. The dictatorship, they are already accomplices of it, you see? And they are the same who tomorrow will applaud something, someone else or something else. You see, there is a very bitter poem of Aleko's about that, where he called them the flock. And which is a word that I've used in this book. And I have expressed all these all over the book. But there is a page in which I insist particularly, and it is a very sad page. Also funny, because the book is also funny. That's the point. He was a funny man also. and it is the episode of the great rally of Karamanlis, who would become prime minister, who already was prime minister at that time. And that day, Alekos was taking a rally. It was a small rally with not even 30 people who were listening to him in disbelief or who were unhappiness because he was saying the truth to them. And he said, don't be fooled. It is your fault if they fool you, etc. And only 30 people were there to listen to him, and a million and a half were listening to Karamanlis. And I say in the book, I had seen the people who you believed understood you and who would elect you. I had seen them arrive orderly, disciplined, regimented, a real flock that goes where those who command wanted to go, those who promise, those who frighten. And it proceeds with closed eyes, and since there is no need to see the road. The road is a solid stream of fleece that will arrive at the square chosen by the power in charge. For instance, Syntagma Square in Athens, and long live Karamanlis. In other instances, Piazza Venezia in Rome, and long live Mussolini. Piazza San Pietro in the Vatican, and long live the Pope. Alexanderplatz in Berlin, and long live Hitler. Trafalgar Square in London, and long live Her Majesty the Queen. Place de la Concorde in Paris, and long live de Gaulle. The Square of Celestial Peace in Peking, and long live Mao Zedong. It's a bitter truth.
Well, you describe in the opening of your book, during his funeral, when there's crowds of people gathering around his coffin crying, Z, Z, he lives, he lives, but kind of blindly in a way. And you say you had to make sure that the coffin was balanced. You were afraid they were going to knock it over in their enthusiasm.
Oh, it was
enthusiasm.
Unbelievable. I know.
So it was going to cause perhaps the destruction of the very, you know, of the body of the very person who they were there to sing the praises of.
Yes, I know. And I tell you one thing, that day, paradoxically, I was kind of happy for him. In my unbearable grief, I was kind of happy. And I remember that I turned to him, and he was in this coffin. I said, see, Alekos, see, Alekos. I was also kind of mad, let's admit it. See, Alekos, they're here. But in the book, I also say, just in the prologue and that you mentioned, that I know that it will be only one day. Though, after they will forget and they will go back, though it is that one day that counts. Because what these kind of people like Alekos leave, it is a seed that sooner or later will blossom. So that day counts. Only one day, it's unfair, and it is enraging.
Can you think of an instance in recent history in the past, during this decade, for instance, where you feel that a large part of the population of a country acted together in strength and in positive, in a positive movement with thinking fully and not as a flock, not as sheep, the way...
Well, yes, but to fall under other masters again and again. Vietnam. I mean, the Vietnamese, they acted all together. And it was really great, really heroic what they do. But go now to Hanoi and go now to Saigon and see what is the result. Did they die for that? See? I would love to think that today in Vietnam there is one Alekos. That is the whole point. And if you want to know if I have met other Alekos, yes. You know, I've been well educated. I'm a very privileged person because I was not born rich, but I was born in an anti-fascist family. And I used to say that I'm a child of the resistance. And I am the daughter of my father and not my mother, who fought so fantastically against the Nazi fascists during the resistance. And I grew up with those people. You see that we don't even know the name. Very often.
If so many causes that have been taken up have led to the formation of new dictators or new regimes to replace, new evil regimes to replace the old evil regimes, where do you get your enthusiasm or optimism to keep up the spirit of resistance, having seen so many failures around you?
You have to, otherwise you give up life. The idea of life itself. You see, in the other book, I don't remember if I say here in a man, but there must be a page in which I pointed out. In the other book of mine, Letter to a Child Never Born, when the woman explains to the embryo what life is, will be, there is a phrase. And this phrase was given to me by Alekos. He helped me when I read the Gallis. He gave me a few ideas. As a poet, because he was a poet in any sense. He wrote marvelous poems, you know, and there were two books got two very important literary prizes in Italy. And the phrase said, the importance is not to win. What is important is not to win, it is to struggle. What is important is not to arrive, it is to travel, because once you have arrived, you discover that the trip is not over and you have to start all over again, like the Vietnamese today in Vietnam. I mean, what is the other alternative? The other alternative is motionless, resignation. It's death. I mean, I don't even put to myself the problem. That pragmatic question. All right, it's useless, so what? It's in me, it's in us, in the people who believe like that.
Alekos was arrested initially for his failed assassination attempt on George Papadopoulos. Now, many Americans, I think, would react to that as if it as to an act of terrorism, because it's violence, yeah. And the question is always asked, when sure. Is political violence justified? So let me put that question to you. When do you think assassination or other forms of political violence are justified?
Yes, I have seen in these last weeks, speaking about this book, many say like that, but at the beginning I got very angry. But then I became more indulgent, because this is because of a political ignorance that you must admit that exists in this country. They, in that sense, you really live in an island. And what is fantastic that you travel so much, but as tourist. You go to places, and when you get there, you only think of enjoying the sea, the weather, the food, how good are the scallopine, how beautiful is, how blue is the sea in Greece. You never try... Never, I don't want to insult everybody, but the most of the people, they don't try to understand what is the reality in which they go in. Who are the men and women who are behind that? What happens in those countries? You see, look how the way how they pronounce the word socialist, if it was it were a dirty word, and so an act like the one of Alekos is considered by them an act of terrorism, which is simply out of political ignorance. I mean, would you call terrorists those who were fighting, like my father, like my companions, in the resistance against the Nazi fascists? No, I guess you wouldn't. So why should you call him? It is exactly the same thing. It's the same resistance 30 years later. I mean, and it takes place, besides, in a society, in a country like Greece, in which killing the tyrant since the time of Pericles was considered the highest gesture, and to the tyrannicid monuments should be elected, and laurel crowns should be given. Of course, he felt a repugnancy. You say repugnance? Repugnancy. I would feel it also. I don't know if I would be capable of doing it. I don't know if I would have the guts. But if a Mussolini would be reborn in my country, or in Hitler, I would feel a coward if I wouldn't kill him, and I would not be ready to die with him in order to kill him. See what I mean? I mean, there is a difference, and I found it even grotesque, hilarious to point it out, between the Red Brigades, so-called Red Brigades, who kill in time of democracy in a country like mine, where you can choose, you have such a wide range of choice from the extreme left to the extreme right, and we have a parliament, you have free press, you can express yourself, do that, and they kill people. This is not racism. This is terrorism. Or when you put a bomb on a plane, the Palestinians put a bomb on a plane and they kill everybody. Or they put a bomb in a bus and they kill 25 children who are going to school. What the hell of politics is that? But for Christ's sake, killing the tyrants, I must say, should be one of the Ten Commandments. He said, and I say in the book, that he had to make an effort to do it, you know. He said that even holding a gun nauseated him. You see? And he, even seeing blood, and when he had been released from prison and he came to Italy, and people went to listen to him, I remember to have seen a priest in the city of Modena crying, and then getting up and going to him and killing him. Because he said, really, with such a sincerity, such an honesty, I remember him was the man who said, I did not want to kill a man. I'm incapable of killing a man. I wanted to be a tyrant, to kill. I wanted to kill a tyrant. A tyrant is not a man. And yet, he used to tell me that even in that moment, he felt so uncomfortable. And you know, when he was preparing the attempt, he never looked at Papadopoulos. He had never seen Papadopoulos in his face. Because when he was preparing the attempt, he had seen the photos. Or on TV, because when he was preparing the attempt, he was on that street measuring the time and seeing what time the car would come. He told me that he turned his shoulder when the car passed. And I said, because you didn't want, you were afraid they would recognize you. He said, no, with those pure eyes, because I didn't want to see his face, because if I saw his face, I wouldn't do it. See?
Well, let me just reintroduce you for our listeners just tuning in. My guest is Oriana Fallaci, and we're talking about the subject of her new book, which is called A Man, and it's just been published by Simon & Schuster. And it's a book about the years of her life that she spent with Alexander Panagoulis, who was in the Greek resistance. Now, he was in prison for trying to assassinate George Papadopoulos, the military dictator in Greece. He was tortured repeatedly in prison. He was finally released during a period of general amnesty. And
he was not condemned to death for death. He was not condemned to death for the attempt. He was condemned to death as leader of the Greek resistance movement. Yeah. Excuse me for interrupting you.
Well, we've just talked about assassination and what it was like for him to try to take the life of a man who was a tyrant. Let's look at now at the symbolic action, the action that is going to be difficult to do, very risky, but it's only going to be a symbol.
Yeah.
Now, he wanted to, at some point, raise a red flag in the Acropolis, and he loved the idea of the red against the white of the building and what might be a very blue sky, very striking and stirring. Not because he was a communist, but because
the red flag doesn't belong to the communist only. It's like the fist. When you raise the fist, I have seen the other day Ted Kennedy with his fist up in a photo published by Time magazine. I mean, they have no prerogative special.
But anyways, to do this, he was practically holding auditions amongst other people in the resistance to see who would have the courage to really work through an action like this, and who, on the other hand, wouldn't turn on him and squeal, because that was a problem that you had to watch out for. And the last person who he spoke to in the auditions for this action said, listen, this is not a good action. It's an act of narcissism. It's not an important gesture. It's not going to do anything. It's ego. It's your ego expressing itself. Now, how would you react to something like that? Do you think that...
I don't agree with those who call it narcissism. I was against the action. I didn't want him to do it because it was foolish, because I want to keep him alive. I thought it would be stupid to be killed like that. I wanted him to last because... Not only because I loved him, but politically I thought that it was the right thing to do. It would be useful. He had to be alive. But then, listen, if that was narcissistic, and then also it had been done already, you know, during the Second World War, during the Greek resistance to the Nazi fascist. A man called, I don't remember his name, is Savlos Angelos. He had gone on into the Acropolis nighttime, and he has raised the red flag, taking off the German flag. Was it narcissistic? Oh, God, it was damn useful. Can you imagine the meaning of that? For the people that morning and get up and see there is no more the German flag, there is the red flag. But even for 1 hour, even for 1 minute... God bless that narcissism, if narcissism exists. The point is that, as I tell in a man, is that they said like that out of cowardice, because they wouldn't do it, they were afraid. You see, people who are afraid, who don't want to participate, they will find any justification. First I said I have the wife, I have the children, that's one of their slogans. Now I mention cowardice. I mean, the cowardice expresses through accusations. Narcissism.
Well, you said you didn't want him to do this in part because you wanted to keep him alive. So sure. What's the difference between you wanting to keep him alive and someone who's married to a man?
The difference is that I didn't want to do it, but I was ready to do it if he would do it. Not approving, but I would do it.
You describe yourself in your book as being a Sancho Panza to his Don Quixote. And at one point, I just want to quote something you write. You write him a letter at one point, and this is the way you describe the letter in your book. You say, I wrote you a letter explaining my refusal to continue such a relationship. I wasn't Penelope who weaves her veil waiting for Ulysses, the letter said. I was Ulysses myself, had always lived like Ulysses, and the fact that for you I had betrayed my own nature by becoming Sancho Panza didn't authorize your arrogance in certain instances.
Yeah.
And you left him for a few days.
No, you see, it was really, you said stormy relationship. It was a great love. A great love cannot be that serene, especially when they take place between two people like us with very precise personalities, you see. Because I play the role of Sancho Panza, and of course it is also a literary device. Consent me to say that this is a novel, and so it makes part of the literary devices to build the story. I was in my little, I was a Don Quixote myself, and it was not only a case of different personalities, but. Or a case of education, Greek manner, kind of patriarchal, etc. It was the strength of his personality, because he would keep that attitude not only on me, with me, but with the men who were his friends, his squires, I used to call them. He would do it with anybody. And, do you want to know what I feel? Especially now, he was entitled to. He had the right to do it. He had the right to do it because he was a leader. The point is that his leadership clashed with mine. See?
Well, don't you think that there's a problem in some relationships where, say someone is a political leader, but in a relationship, in a love relationship, political leadership should maybe not enter into the part of a relationship two people have that's reserved
you want
for love.
To, You want a perfect world, do you? The human beings are what they are, thanks God, because they are so imperfect. It doesn't happen only with man. I mean, I recall very well when Golda Meir told me that she had this problem with his husband on the other way around. She was the Alekos of the situation, and the husband was the woman. In the book, the woman is unnamed. We don't know who she is. I don't even describe her physically. So the woman of the book, and let's say in reality, in my story with Alekos. I mean, when you have the encounter exists of this with this human type, one of the two, at a certain extent, has to give up, has to follow the other. And indeed, at a certain extent, if I think, well, maybe a little less than what I tell in the book, I gave up. Because you know the very real reason why I did. It is that I knew he would die. He knew he would die soon, and I knew he would die soon. I did anything not only to make him a little happier, but to be less alone and to make life more acceptable, the little time that he had to live.
But weren't there times maybe when you tried to keep the political leadership outside of your house together?
Of course. We were two human beings, I told you before. You don't see us all the time discussing about ideologies and discussing about the red flags to be put on the Acropolis or about communism and capitalism and things like that. We also had very, very, I told before, funny moments. I mean, we were lovers. What do you expect from us?
During the late 60s and early 70s in this country, when there was a strong political activism and...
Yes, what happened out of it?
Well, a lot of women gave up on the movements that they were part of, in part because they felt that they were allowed to be accomplices of the men within the movement, but they weren't really allowed active roles within it. They weren't usually the speakers. They weren't the people in the meetings who were deciding what the next action was going to be and who were in the front lines of the action.
You are saying a big truth, a big historical truth that doesn't apply only to you. It applies to many other countries and many other circumstances. Look what happened in Algeria. Remember the Algerians, the fight against the French? My God, what the women did. And when everything was over, they were sent back to the kitchens. Look what happened in Vietnam. In Vietnam, God knows, I have seen the girl Viet Cong, and I've seen their corpses after a combat, for Christ's sake. But when everything was over, their Viet Cong fellows took the power. This is an historical truth. It has always happened. There's only one way not to have it happen, not to permit it. I mean, why did the Algerian women accept that? Why the Vietnamese women accept that? You shouldn't. They shouldn't. I wouldn't. I was very much of an activist. That's why I called it a stormy relationship also, because of that. I mean, I behaved with him, as I said before, but I never denied myself. And in my country, one of the... There are not many things, not even my country, to go very proud, but one thing to go proud is that Parliament is filled with women. God knows how many women. I mean, I don't think that in your Parliament, in your Congress, there are as many women as there are in mine. On the point, and I don't know how to resolve, because everybody, here we go, this book is a hymn to individualism. And for Christ's sake, you have to resolve things on an individual basis. I'm very tough with the women who play victims, you see, and who like to victimize themselves and to explain or to justify their status saying, but we cannot, if you cannot, you do. They don't let us, if they don't let us, you do it all the same. This was never a problem in my life. It's also a matter of education. I was, again, well-educated in that sense. I was never told that when you will be grown up, you will marry and have children. If I wanted to do it, of course, I would do it. One of my sisters has done it. But I was told, you will work, you will know the world. You will go to work, you will know to know the world.
I'm told by a friend of mine who lived for about a year, I think, in Greece, that it's very difficult for women there to be equal in any way, that a lot of men hang out in bars together in which or clubs in which women aren't allowed to set foot.
And why do they accept it? I didn't.
Well, let me ask you, if Alekos was able to succeed with the kind of overthrowing of the regime that existed and was able to help in the creation of a different regime, do you think that with in a different government, I should say, do you think that within that women would have equality within the system, or would that be a new struggle that women would first have to fight afterwards?
In spite of the fact that he was a Greek man with all the patriarchalism that this involves, and there was part of it in him, but he was aware, which is the good thing. He had politically a great respect for women in politics. I remember there was an old woman, there were only in the Greek parliament six congress people in the Greek parliament of the Communist Party. Well, there are two Communist Party in Greece, but we go too far. And there was one woman, an old woman. The respect and the love that Alekos had for her, he said to me, you don't know how extraordinary she is. He also used very often to avoid the expression men and women. They have in Greece that holy word, anthropos, which means person, but more than person. It doesn't mean man and it doesn't mean woman. It can be translated with person, but I feel it's more than that. And he always predicated with the word anthropos. He always said anthropos, anthropy. He never said men and women. When I speak, I always feel the necessity, since our language expresses itself in that way, with the masculine, and say men, and then I say and women. I said I did it before. He said anthropy, anthropos, which meant that.
Yeah.
So I like to believe that he would have done something. Besides, women worked for him when he was in politics. Yes,
because of what you said, where in a lot of revolutions after the fact, when a lot of wars after the fact, women first have to struggle for their own place within that society. Some women believe that international feminism should be put first in the politics of women, since we've seen so many revolutions where women continue to be subservient after the war is allegedly won.
But see, Terry, I see that you care very much about this subject. Then I answer to you in a very simple way, very quick way. This book is called A Man because it tells the story of a man. But it could be a woman and tell the story of a woman. It would be exactly the same book. You understand what I mean? It would be exactly the same book. It's because I chose that individual. If I have known among the women a woman that would strike me as much as Alekos, of course it wouldn't be the love story. Because I happen not to be an homosexual, but if I would be, I would have the same admiration, and I would have the same belief in that person as I had in Alekos. Today, you would have a book entitled "A Woman," and I don't even follow you so much in what you say. I understand it is a truth, but just insisting on it feeds what you don't like to happen. It depends on us, I told you.
Okay.
Revolution takes place in the individual, he says, I say, in this book.
So you...
The fact itself that I wrote it, not he wrote it. I said, well, okay, he's dead. But if he was alive, he wanted to write the book, etc. And I say this thing, and I am a woman, not a man. This kind of book, not okay. easily expected from a woman.
Right, but I guess what I'm talking about isn't the possibility for individual greatness at this point, but what happens to whole groups of people after a revolution is said to be won.
What happens?
Well, I guess what I'm asking is...
It happens what you want to happen, because if you give up and go back to the kitchen, tant pis, we say in French, for you. If you don't go, of course, it's more difficult for us than for the others, the way the society is organized, because women have to take care of children. But this, too, is changing. Come on, it is not changing in America. Tant pis again for you. I mean, if you go to my country, it's almost unbelievable how, in that sense, things have changed more in Europe than here, and particularly in my country. And I must admit one great truth, that the left has great responsibility in that sense, because they have educated people. If you go to Turin, where there is the Fiat, and there you'll find the men and women doing the same work with different time schedules. And once I was there and I spoke with them, interviewed them, I said, who's cooking? Who's cleaning the house? I was interviewing the young couples, of course. And they said, the first one who gets home. If it is he cooks first and cleans the house. If it is me, the woman said, I do it. You see, you have to start doing that. But besides, I know that you have very few but marvelous examples in these countries. But men who have chosen to stay at home with children. But this is no more the book. We were speaking about Alekos. We are going a little too far, if you permit me. Because
Let me get back to Alekos. He says to
the book,
the narrator of the book, yes, that you'll never really love me till I'm dead. So let me ask you, in real life, how his death affected the way you felt about him as a man and as someone in the resistance.
You know, the book begins with these words. Let me find them, because a roar of grief and rage rose over the city. This roar was mine. Of course, it was that day also. I used those words because that's the way I felt, how it affected me. Oh, well, he was fooling me when he was said, you will love me when I'm dead. I mean, he was kind of joking or provoking me, because I cannot conceive a greater love than the one I gave to him when he was alive. But one thing is true, that I always avoid saying I loved him. I say I love him when I go on loving him. You mean how it changed me, how it has affected me in terms of changing me? It changed me in the sense that I became harder as temperament, much harder, much tougher. It changed me in the sense that I'm more enraged also. My hope in the humans was wounded severely. You can answer, why did you need that? Of course, again, we go back to the fact that we are human beings, and when we are hit directly, we have to... You cannot judge people only for their brain and only for their capability of reasoning. I keep repeating in this book, man is done also, has also stomach, a heart, sphincters. That is the whole problem. And so it affected me in that way. But as much as I feel sometimes a kind of cynicism, I say, at the same time, I say what we said before, you got to struggle all the same. It can be an act of despair. Why not? It helps.
I got the impression that you think that there are political groups within Greece after he died who tried to use his death as a symbol to promote their cause, a cause that perhaps he wouldn't have espoused.
That too is inevitable. It was inevitable. It is not that I was silly enough to have illusions in that sense. I knew it would happen. It's always happened. It will always happen. I mean, you don't do anything for a person, and when that person is dead, if it is useful, you use it. You know, the vampires had to arise. And I will not insist on that because I don't want to publicize them, and they ask nothing better than being publicized so they can answer to me and make titles on their newspapers. The fact is that when he went around doing those rallies, there were 30 people. And now at the rallies, that those who were his opponents, the people that for which he had contempt, now have stolen his body, his grave, and his memory for their dirty interest. And they make rallies for him the 1st of May. It's disgusting. I shall never go back to because of that. I don't want to see that. I don't want to see the people, the so-called leftist, who, like Papandreou, that, you know, for him, for whom he had so much contempt, now making rallies on his grave. It's very hard for me to bear, even as I do understand it, because this is politics, and I know politics, I understand politics, I'm a political woman. It has always happened, it will always happen, and let's stop with that.
As a reader of your book, I really wanted to keep finding out more about the character who was like you, the narrator of the book, the woman who is lovers with Alekos, but who, as you said, is not physically described, and who is in the book as a narrator, but it's mentioned, we know this person is a writer because when she goes to him to interview him, he's read her books.
Yeah.
But I really kept wanting to know more about you and what you were feeling and how much of your own work you were willing to give up for the relationship and for his cause. And what you were thinking.
Oh, I tell you what I give up. I gave up Chile because the death of Allende came soon after he had been released. And I wanted to go to Chile. I couldn't go in those days because we couldn't enter, but after we would, of course. But I was caught in the middle. Do I go to write my sense of being outraged of all, not all mine, of all the, everybody, for the killing of Allende? Or do I leave this man alone so that we got another Allende? He dies too. And I chose to stay with him. And I did well. Of course, from a selfish point of view, as a journalist, as an historian, as a political person, a person who is so involved, I want to be in Chile, but I had to be with him because otherwise he would be killed and we would get, as I said, another Allende. I lost Watergate. I almost never was in America in those years. Very, very rarely, for very, very few days. But there was another reason. And it's the reason that in America, when we speak about a man, about this book, I'm surprised. The journalists never pick it up. Can I mention it? It is the episode of the passport. The visa to come to America when he had been released had been denied to him. Because he had been condemned to death, he had been in the military prison as an exponent of the Greek resistance because he had attempted the life of Papadopoulos. And the reason, and they had motivated this, was moral torpitude. It's so funny to imagine Alekos guilty of moral torpitude. But last night I was seeing a program where they were speaking about my friend Ingrid Bergman, and I saw that also Ingrid got that label, moral torpitude, when she married Rossellini. So you must be kind of used. What happened that day? He wanted to come to America because he wanted to go on with the resistance. He was looking for help, and he wanted to see the people who had been helping him when he was in prison. And it had not been only Johnson who had been asked to spare his life, not because Johnson cared about Alekos, but they could not afford the Americans an execution of that kind with all the problems of NATO, etc. It would be mostly uncomfortable. But there were senators and there were congressmen who had done much for him. He wanted to come to ask their help to fight the military junta, the dictatorship, which still was there when he had come in exile to Italy. And as the book tells, the day we went to this American consulate, they gave him the visa. And at a certain point, the secretary, they gave him the visa, they put the stamp on the passport, and a moment before the vice consul would sign it, the secretary of the vice consul said, "Poor soul, look at his face. How can you see how much he suffered?" And then he stopped immediately. He didn't put the signature, and he said, "Why you suffered?" "Well," he said with his pure face, "you know, in prison, and that prison, it was very hard." "I said, why were you in prison?" "And I said, don't you know, you have his name in front of you. And who is this man? This man is Alekos Alexandrov Panagoulis." And he said, "Where have you been in the last 5 years?" And Alekos said, "I wrote it, because when filling the paper, they had to write." He said, "Where have you been in your last years?" And he had written the military prison of Boyati, and he hadn't read it. So he canceled the stamp with another stamp, canceled. And Alekos wanted to publish the second book of poems, the jacket of the book. He wanted to put the page of this, of his dirtied passport. He had dirtied. It was tremendous, because wherever he went in Europe, when he passed the frontier, they saw this page with this black consulate. You see, it immediately came to your eyes. People got very suspicious and nervous.
But getting back to how much you were willing to give up in...
Oh, yeah, that was your question.
Yeah.
Well, I gave up a lot, but I didn't give up all, because I worked in those years also. I mean, I even went back to Vietnam for the end of the war in the summer, May, June, 75. I went to Saigon, and for the 12th, 13th time.
You have always been the kind of interviewer whose personal point of view is not a secret. But to be involved in this relationship with someone who was imprisoned for an attempted assassination is quite a statement. I wonder if that affected at all your ability to get audience with people, or for interviews, or your credibility in any way as a journalist. Because in this country, for instance, objectivity is one of the most valued traits of a journalist.
What do you mean by objectivity? I'm objective. What is this country objective? Objectivity is, they say facts, not opinion, right? Well, to begin with, if they did not like my way of writing, why would I be so much known in this country? Why they would teach my way of making journalists in the University of Journalism, to begin with? There must be something good if they love me so much. Secondly, I mean, it's a great honor to have been the woman of this man, and everybody knows, and now everybody shares this belief that it is an honor. I mean, I find even you are not aware of it. I don't want to hurt you, my God, even insulting what you have said. It's offensive to me to accept to speak about this. I mean, because if I were the woman of Garibaldi, they shouldn't see me or what? I don't understand. It's everybody knew that I was the woman of Alekos. You went back making another mistake, using the word revolutionary in the wrong sense, but in any case, revolutionary is a holy word for me, and I don't want to see it spoiled like that. I see whom I want, and they are honored to receive me.
I know that's true.
They receive not only me; they receive the woman of Alekos.
Would You describe in your book, or the narrator of the book describes, how there were times during the relationship when she or you wanted to disentangle yourself from the cause of Alekos, from the culture of Greece.
No, I never say that. Not the cause of Alekos. To that kind of life that absorbed me so much. But I didn't do it. Again, we're human. I'm not. This is a novel, listen, Terry. This is a novel which is a political novel, I say. Some see in it the love story only. Worse for them. The love story, in my opinion, it's a tool to tell the political story. But it is also the story of a human being for half of it, and then of two human beings. And when you tell again the story of two human beings, you, as I said before, you did not expect us to be always there discussing about capitalism and communism and things like that. And so it must tell also their sentiments. I make the portrait of him, and consequently, in a hidden way, because all over the book I keep myself behind him, in shadow, which has nothing to do with feminism or anti-feminism. When Ismael tells the story of Ahab and Moby Dick, I mean, you don't know much about Israel. Ismael, you don't even care. Ismael is the one who survived to this the sinking of the ship, who survived to the death of all the other. He remains, and his duty is to tell the story of Ahab and of Moby Dick. So the approach is the same one. But since I tell about myself a little more than Ismael tells about himself, it sounds a little pretentious to take such a divine example, but everybody knows Moby Dick, that's why I chose Moby Dick. Then you go also, if you want to tell about them, you call their anguishes, their joys. It's an over.
You're pretty certain that the death of Alekos was engineered by his political enemies. Since you were revealing information that they wouldn't want him to reveal, did you feel while you were writing this book, or do you feel now, that your life is in any way endangered?
Now? Oh, no, now, no. I mean, now it would be a stupid revenge. I mean, it's ridiculous. That would help the book. I mean, instead of a million 200,000 copies I've sold in 1 year in Italy, I would sell 10 millions. And here in America it goes so well, it would go even better. No, that's even grotesque to conceive such an idea. I was in danger, of course, when I was writing the book. That's evident. I mean, it was known. I mean, it's true that I slept in my country house with a loaded gun next to my bed in my room, and my father with a loaded gun next to his bed. Of course, I mean, I had those documents. The documents he had left to me. And a copy of them, of course, and two originals so that nobody has. I have them, and I didn't make any mystery that I would use them. I had said it publicly, repeated it, and in fact, one day I was called by the head of the anti-terrorism in Rome and said, "Falaschi, what do you do? What do you do to protect yourself?" I said, "Nothing. What do you want me to do to protect myself? If they want to do it, they do it." And especially where I was living, it was a country house and in the top of a hill. I mean, far from anything, they could have done it. The poor carabinieris of the village in the night came always to give a look, but you see. Well, I tell you how I made anything impossible to happen to me. I did a smart thing, but it was not my idea. It was someone else's idea. I said that copies of these documents had been put in all the banks of Europe and of America. And if something happened to me, even if I died because I caught a cold or because I ate too much, which is not very possible, automatically those documents would be printed and revealing that his murderers were also my murderers. It was not true. I never had the time to go to bring the documents. Now they are in the bank. But at that time, I would not leave that room where I was working. So I never went in the banks to bring the document. They were there with me. I always said, oh, God, tomorrow I have to make another copy. Or tomorrow I have to... And then I never did it. And so that, but that was very smart move, very political.
Has the book been translated into Greek?
It will be out, God knows what it will happen, in January. It has been translated in, first it was printed in Italian, with that unbelievable success that I told you. I hate the word success, oh God. My vocabulary is very limited in English, you know what I mean. I mean, many people read it, millions of people read it. Then it has been published, it goes very well in Germany, Spain, Yugoslavia, both in Serbian, Croatian, Slovenian. Slovenian is going to be out this week. And in Holland. And now it has to be out, now it's out in America. And then it will be out in England, Australia, Canada, etc. In January in French, and then in Norway, in Denmark, in Finland. So many countries. Japanese, it will be in the spring, in April. I'm always translated that much, I must say. A Letter to a Child Never Born has been translated in 24 countries. It's been printed in 24 countries and 22 languages. I don't remember exactly. But I didn't expect this, because you know what has been said of this book? I love that definition of this book. This is an uncomfortable book about an uncomfortable man written by an uncomfortable woman. I love that.
Now that the book is done, what are some of the projects that you're working on now?
I am pregnant of so many books that I could give birth to a quintuplets. I have to recover. It has been, you know, it took 3 years to write it. And when the 3 years were over, then there was the anguish of the publication, all that. And each time it's published in a new language, they come and repeat, and it starts all over again. If I would like to forget about it, but I cannot, not as yet. Therefore, it keeps vampirizing me or haunting me. And it is like, you know, it is like taking water from a well. Eh? And then the well, it gets dry at a certain moment. And you have to fill it with water again before I go back doing something important. In the meantime, I do some journalistic work and can do, if it happens, get reportage or an important interview as I did in China with Deng Xiaoping. Or the others, Gaddafi, whom in Khomeini I did recently. But you know, for me, that it's kind of, it's like a vacation. To do that kind of work, it seems to me, after the effort of this book, which I rewrote so many times, it seems to be so easy to go and speak with Deng Xiaoping. Of course, there is tremendous work behind it. But compared to this. So before I publish another book, some time will pass. Besides, I have published 9 books, it's true, but always usually on much distance. It was 4 years. Letter to a Child Never Born was published in 1975. This is of 79, 74 in Italy, 75 here, and now we are in the 80s. And before Letter to a Child Never Born, I'd written the book on Vietnam, Interview with History, which was of 3 years before. And before that, Nothing and Subito on Vietnam, so which had been 4 years. There is always a distance of 3 years, 4 years. I'm not a very prolific writer, which is good. I mean, I wouldn't respect myself if I were one of those who write a book in 1 year. How can you write a book every year? It's not serious.
Well, I'll look forward to seeing your next book in 3 or 4 years when it's ready to be completed. Oriana Fallaci, it's been very wonderful to meet you, and I thank you very much for speaking with us today.
Thank you.
I've been speaking with Oriana Fallaci, and the book that we've been discussing, her new book, is called A Man. It's published by Simon & Schuster, and it's about the years of her life. No, it's a novel with real names and real places and real incidents, but when I say her, I guess I mean the narrator, who is really her, so you understand the confusion. But it's a book about Alexander Panagoulos, who tried to assassinate George Papadopoulos, the dictator in Greece.